Even people who claim to love music can pause briefly when asked about certain genres, like rap, for example, and opera for another. These and other forms tend to draw sharp responses, either pro or con. We'll take up opera in this hour, something like an Opera 101 course. Our guest once again is Bela Miller, the arts lecturer. We talked to her about a year ago about the famous Armory Show of major American works of art in 1913. Bela Miller gives lectures around the country on various art forms. She also gives Yiddish lectures about European Jewish life and philosophy, and she works with seniors on memory and mental agility. She'll be delivering a four-part series of lectures on opera at the Jackson County Libraries beginning in Eagle Point. 2 days from now. Bela Miller, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, good morning.
It's been a year since you were here. You've built a very interesting career, and if the folks didn't hear you last year, how did you get into this line of work?
It was almost by accident, because I was doing programs for memory care residents in senior facilities, and I developed with some friends of mine a memory care music program that was spiritual and physical and everything that you could add to the life of people that were suffering from dementia. And I noticed that on other levels, there were areas of care that were being provided by, say, the spouses of these people that were in memory care. So I thought maybe I would approach some of the activity directors and ask them if they wanted other kinds of programming for people that could understand on a higher level. And they said, yes, they might want to use art lectures. So after about 10 or 12 years of doing this on a monthly basis, where I had to come up with a new lecture every month if I was going to go back to the same facility, I've now developed over 80 different kinds of programs. And teaching with Rhodes Scholar and various universities where I'm engaged, I've had to continue to evolve as a teacher.
That's Road, R-O-A-D, Scholar?
Yes, R-O-A-D. Used to be known as Elder Hostel.
Okay, you get that advertised on NPR a lot, I notice.
Yes, they're really big on NPR.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, on the underwriting announcements, I should say. Not advertisements. There's a difference in public radio.
That's right.
So this sounds like fun, but it sounds like a lot of research as well. I mean, have you had to learn a lot more about these arts areas yourself?
Definitely. I would say that about 10 or 12 years ago when I did this, my real education began.
Really?
Yes. My real education began.
I mean, you had a fair amount of information about arts already in your head, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I was a social worker in my first life, and I was an English teacher in my second life. And then this, I fell into this, and it's enriched my life beyond any words that could tell you what my experience is now. Everything I see through the prism of the Greco-Roman foundational world, the classical world, and it all has even deeper meaning.
So when you give lectures on opera, you probably need to go as fast as you can understand it yourself. I mean, so your knowledge is not that deep or that long. Am I making a fair assumption here?
Well, it's if you begin to understand that opera is literature with music, and I do have a foundation in literature, and you begin to see that there are different literary plots that are chosen according to the political and economic times of a culture, then you can already have a springboard with which to understand why, for example, Figaro would have been a subject matter, and he would have been a major character in The Barber of Seville, as opposed to what would have happened during the Renaissance period when there would have been literature written about Orfeo and Eurydice in Italian and Eurydice in French. So the Renaissance period was more connected to the Greco-Roman mystical and mythical world, whereas opposed to in later years after revolutions occur, that the common man is more the subject of the story. So after you understand that basis of what makes opera, the libretto, the text or the play of the story is already given to you and you can make a connection with general history and why that character would be chosen. And then after that, you make a leap forward as to why composers would be there to supplement the story by including the music that will make the storyline more deep because the music is there to support the lyrics.
You just mentioned The Barber of Seville. We actually have one of the pieces in here, Tito Gobbi singing Largo al Factotum from Puccini's The Barber of Seville. So let's put that up and we can talk a bit about it once we've heard some of it. ¶¶ So what's going on here, Bela Miller? I mean, why was this one of the first operas you mentioned, The Barber of Seville?
Well, because a character like Figaro could only have become prominent as a story and plot line because he's a self-made man. He's a self-made man because the Industrial Revolution that happens in the 1700s permits a new kind of character and a new kind of opportunity for people that are not titled gentry, or they're not people that are just born to the lucky genes club in which their parents are dukes or kings, or this kind of opportunity in which life offers you everything good that can happen. So Figaro represents a self-made man who is extraordinarily proud of the fact that not only is he a clever man as a servant, but he is a person of great quality at a time when everyone needs a barber. And it's not because of the wigs only, and because people have to have their hair and different kinds of styles, but it's because he is a man that has done everything with his attributes and skills, so he is now part of a meritocracy as opposed to just someone that happens to be born in the right place and time.
Back with Bela Miller and more opera in just a moment. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about opera today, a little bit about the history, the conduct of it, who were some of the major players through the course of history, because we have Bela Miller available to us. Bela Miller delivers arts lectures across the country. She'll be doing a series of lectures on opera at the Jackson County Library starting this week. Eagle Point on June 26th, Jacksonville June 28th, Ashland June 29th, and the Medford Library July 1st. A four-part series on opera. Love it or hate it, opera certainly engenders strong emotions one way or the other. You're more than welcome to join this discussion on the Exchange, which will intersperse with bits of various arias. Phone numbers here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were just giving us a description of why Figaro is such an important character in The Barber of Seville, and what the representation was and the connection to the time in which the opera was written. Do we know when opera was first composed, written, put together?
Yes, we do. I also wanted to mention one more thing, Jeff, is that every one of these lectures that are being offered are different. They're not the same lecture. So that coming up Thursday, I'll be talking about Claudio Monteverdi, who was the first one that effectively wrote the first major opera during the Renaissance, and he chose a theme that would have been appropriate to its time, and that was a Greek myth about Orfeo and the girl that he falls in love with, Eurydice in Italian and Eurydice in French. So it would have been very appropriate to its times because the Renaissance was a revival of the classical world. Consequently, they would have been exposed, those literary people, the intellectuals, would have been exposed to great dramas and literary pieces from the Greek world. And since they were reviving the Greek and Roman world, that would have been a natural topic for them to employ. Then we're going to have a lecture on Rossini, The Barber of Seville, and then following that it will be Puccini, Madame of Butterfly, and other pieces written by Puccini. And then after that, the fourth lecture will be on Giuseppe Verdi, and we'll talk about the chorus of the Hebrews from the opera. Let's see, the chorus of the Hebrews is from Nabucco. And then we'll have La Traviata, and we'll talk a little bit about other operas by Verdi. However, to get back to Claudio Monteverdi, is the Renaissance was one of those perfect moments in history in which everything came together. There was enough money for the Florentine government to be able to support various business entities in which they were involved and underwrote, banking and textile manufacturing. There was enough money for I would guess, war material. All of those aspects that creates a strong city-state that can defend itself, and then there's also lots and lots of money for the art world. So this is the time in history when we have the David by Michelangelo, and he sculpts that period, and he paints the Sistine Chapel. All of these wonderful art forms that will be revived from the Greco-Roman world, but we will be made even better because there will be better tools with which to make them, and there will be more intellectual capital that's evolving and more to offer. So Monteverdi is the first one that was approached to write an opera by the Florentine Camerata, who were a group of intellectuals, a fraternity of intellectuals, that wanted to understand why is it that the Greek world was so overly consumed with music. If you read about Greek history, there was music everywhere. At the Olympics. In fact, I think some of the Olympic meets included how well you played an instrument.
Really?
Yes, I believe it was. And so they were so obsessed not only with great drama, but they were very much given to the enjoyment of music in every way possible. You went shopping at the Agora, you heard music everywhere. So they wanted to understand what was it that was so completely compelling about music, and the Florentine Camerata tried to answer that question. Now, you understand at that time during the Renaissance, they didn't have the beautiful violin that they will have after Stradivari invents this glorious instrument that can make every sound imaginable. Because after all, a violin is the shape of a woman, if you've ever noticed. And it is a way of caressing this woman on your shoulder and making her cry or weep or whimper or laugh. This is what the violin can do once it's perfected. So as these kind of instruments come to pass, the pianos as opposed to the harpsichord, the violin with its beautiful intonations and nuances, you can have the kind of a story in which the plot line is compelling to begin with, and then it's supported by music that tells you how to feel about the individual words.
That's really interesting that the instrumentation had to catch up to the intention.
Absolutely. You have to have the right tools to produce the right product.
We have a call for you. Let's go to John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Bela Miller about opera.
Hi. Sorry to bother you. I like your program. I love to call.
Nobody.
Okay, the only opera I know of is called Cavalleria Rusticata, and so I'd like her comment. The reason that I ran across that is it's featured in The Godfather Part 3.
Okay.
And so I don't know if you're familiar with it. Any comments, or is it typical? Is it a typical opera? Because I kind of know the plot line in it.
Okay, and what is the plot line? Do you remember when it was written? I think it was written by Leon Cavullo.
It's set in Sicily about the 1900s or so early, and, you know, Turiddu's in love with Lola, but Turiddu's called away to the army, so this is typical opera, just like watching a soap opera on TV. And so Lola marries this older guy who's got money, and anyway, there you go. Soap opera.
that is why we have soap operas, because they are actually designed after operas themselves, but they happen to be paid for by Tide, by Tide detergent,
soap,
so they're known
as
soap operas.
Cavalleria Rusticata, a one-act opera by Pietro Mascagni.
Mascagni, okay.
And the libretto by Giovanni Targione Tozzetti and Guido Menasci.
Oh, I see. Well, I'm not terribly familiar with that opera, but you do say it was written around the 1900s?
He said it looks like 1890.
Okay, so that would have been written during the Art Nouveau period. I don't know that much about it, but I can say this about the subject of opera. One of the reasons that operas would continue to have impact is that they would connect to people's lives as they were living them then. So that, for example, as I said, during the Renaissance period, there would be more stories about gods and goddesses or mortals that are in love with gods and goddesses. But as we continue through history and life changes for an everyday person, he wants to be more like Figaro. He wants to be more like Mimi and La Bohème, because those kind of stories really mean something to us. In La Bohème, for example, Mimi is a simple, impoverished girl that is living in an attic. attic space, very close to other artists that are all the starving artists that are trying to make a living in Paris. But why we can relate to them all is that we know a lot of poor people, and perhaps we are also not well-fed people. And the stories are realistic because she is dying of a dominant disease that was pervasive at that time, and lots of people were suffering with tuberculosis. So the storylines of opera follow along with the evolution of the simple man, effectively, and they become more a core for plot lines because they are meaningful for those people that are attending opera who are more and more simple people.
I see too that Cavalleria Rusticana is often performed in a double bill with Pagliacci,
Pagliacci.
The so-called Cav-Pag double bill.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
How interesting! Because they might be short operas.
Well, it's certainly one act in the case of Cavalleria Rusticana. Our guest on the Jefferson Exchange is Bela Miller. She travels the country giving arts lectures. She'll be giving a series of lectures, not the same lecture four times, but a series of lectures on opera at the Jackson County Libraries, June 26th in Eagle Point, in Jacksonville, June 28th, Ashland, June 29th, Medford Library, July 1st. And you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about opera, love it or hate it. There's a lot to know and learn here. You can join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. We had already talked about the chorus of the Hebrew slaves and how this is going to be one of the pieces you'll be talking about coming up. And we do have that bit from Verdi's Nabucco. So let's listen to a little bit of chorus of the Hebrew slaves and then we can talk about what it's all about. So, Bela Miller, what's going on in the chorus of the Hebrew slaves here? And why has this become so important to so many people?
Well, first you notice that there are drum rolls, and then there's that punch that comes at the beginning of it. It's a way that Verdi designed a choral piece in which the chorus itself becomes the protagonist in the play. This in the opera, this is one of the first times that a chorus who speaks for the people that want to be free, because this is a story about the Jews being taken captive by Nabucodonosor, who is shortened to the name Nabucco. So this, one of the big reasons that this became such an important event for the Italian people is that they were at this very juncture around the 1850s or 60s being ruled by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Because of this sweeping notion of nationalism that was taking over in the European world, a lot of nations wanted to be free and throw off other kingdoms that were ruling them. So Va Pensiero, because it was an opportunity for Verdi to understand that he could take a story from the ancient world in which the Jews were trying to overthrow their oppressor, Nabucodonosor, and return to Israel, it was going to be synonymous with the fact that the Italian world wanted its freedom. So this became the unofficial national anthem of the Italian world, and it would be presented to them in a way that everyone could learn this song and sing it, so that it would give the Italian army, which was being led by Garibaldi, by the way, which was also underwritten financially by Verdi, who was an important patriot, and who was a man that could afford to underwrite the three meals a day and the armaments and the thousand soldiers that had to fight to show the Austro-Hungarian Empire that they could fight for their own freedom, and they were willing to do it. So it became this unofficial national anthem for them, and it was a way for them to sing about the chorus of the Hebrews and not be charged with treason.
Okay, so it would have been very, very dangerous for Verdi to go ahead and try to do an opera about his own particular time, but he can do this thinly veiled reference to
yes.
something at a different point in history, which people could immediately grab onto and go, "Hey, that's us."
Yeah, that's us. And not only is that not only a picture of who we are and what we want, but it was such a catchy tune. And by the way, one of the reasons that this tune becomes so compelling is that it's one of the only arias that I know of that is played twice at every presentation. Otherwise, the audience goes insane. They have to hear it again. It becomes so addictive because it's so powerful. And it's not only that the words are so meaningful, but what happens with the music is, and the way that Verdi sets the music, and this is, by the way, why you always know who the composer is, but not necessarily who the librettist is. You know who the composer is because of the way that he sets the music. Every word that would mean something to you as someone that wants liberation is the kinds of words that remind you of your country, mi parte, about your beloved ancestors, about the land that you want to walk again as a free man. He knew how to set the very words that would bring you to your knees.
We have an email here from Scott Cole, who is concertmaster with the Rogue Valley Symphony and the Rogue Opera, and he wants to give us a correction on the violin. Not invented by Stradivari, it was in existence from at least the 1550s, well before Monteverdi's Orfeo was presented, that was not as commonly used as the viols. Stradivari learned his craft from the Amatis. Also, Stradivari's instruments were not preferred as concert instruments until after his death, when Viotti played one in Paris around 1800. They were much brighter sounding and more projecting than the extant instruments. So a little.
That's true. But if you do look at a picture of a Renaissance troubadour or Renaissance minstrels that were singing, then you get a picture of how very large the violin was. In fact, the violin was almost twice as large as it was later when it was being more and more perfected for the sweeter sound. So that, I cannot argue with someone that knows more about it than I do, but if you do look at those Renaissance pictures, you see that it was a cumbersome instrument that did not have the sweetness that would later come.
I've been asked to point out, you're not exactly an opera expert, but you're an expert on teaching the appreciation of opera.
Oh, there yes, of course, okay. Of course, right. So yes. And one cannot know everything.
No, and certainly with opera, there's a lot to know. I want to grab another piece here and play it before we get to the break. Puccini's Madama Butterfly. This is Montserrat Caballé singing Un bel di vedremo, and we can talk about the significance of this.
Okay.
And as you point out in one of your lectures, Bela Miller, that Madama Butterfly is Japanese, Lieutenant Pinkerton is American, and yet they're singing in Italian.
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously, the people who are going to compose these, and this is Puccini again, will write in the language they know, or compose in the language they know. He didn't do the libretto for this either, I'm sure.
No, he did not compose the libretto. In fact, Madama Butterfly, one of the reasons, and it's actually quite a long explanation as to why an American and a Japanese girl would be standing in a pagoda singing in Italian. One of the big reasons for that is because of the sweeping philosophy known as nationalism that became an opportunity for nations to become proud of themselves in the European world around the 1850s or so after various revolutions. But what happened as a result of people being able to move around because of industrialization, because all of these things are happening at the same time, and because railroad systems are now being interconnected in the European world, somebody like Brahms would have heard the music of the gypsy players because they would have been maybe moving through Hamburg where he was. And so this interconnected world that becomes of, and makes a person effectively a citizen of the world, because you can travel to different localities and be exposed to the sounds of different nations' music, then after nationalism, what happens is there is a movement that becomes known as exoticism. So that someone like Ravel or someone like Debussy even later, or Brahms or Bartok, will be introduced to other nations' sounds, and they will also be introduced and kind of combining the world of folk music with classical music. So the fact that someone like Ravel or someone like Bartok would have recorded the music of other nations, that became an exotic component that was added to music to give it more of a personality.
More with Bela Miller and opera in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Bela Miller, who travels the country giving lectures on the arts. She is about to deliver a series of four lectures, not the same lecture four times, but four different lectures about opera. It's an opera appreciation series. Think of it as that, starting at the Eagle Point Library in 2 days and finishing up in the Medford Library on July 1st, with stops in Jacksonville and Ashland in between those 2 points. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange here and now if you'd like to talk about opera, opera history, opera conduct and delivery. 800-838-3037. Let me try this again. 800-838-3760. That's around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I wanted to ask, we were just talking about Madame Butterfly and the circumstances there, and we're talking about people moving around the world more easily. So we have a Japanese woman and an American man. They're, of course, singing in Italian because it's a Puccini opera, but the operas and the earlier example of the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Verdi's Nabucco, which is really talking about circumstances in their own time, but removed by several hundred years, if not several thousand years in that case.
Yeah.
Just to make it sort of a safer thing to talk about. But the fact is, it seems like there are often circumstances from the times in which these operas are first produced that are thrust upon these stories that are very old. But it's a fairly common thing, isn't it, that they're showing the ways that people relate in today's world, but hundreds, if not thousands of years before.
Yes. It went back and forth, but it tended to move forward in terms of realism. This is one of the things that art is so good at, is that artists put their finger sort of on the pulse of the day that they're living in. And they try to take, say, structures from the ancient world of how plot lines are designed, but they choose those stories that are meaningful for that day. There actually was a story in a newspaper about an American captain that fell in love with a Japanese geisha, but he wasn't terribly serious about her, and she was very serious about him. So it was one of those stories that is a heartbreaker because a young innocent girl is truly in love with a man and he's lackadaisical about marrying her, when in actual fact in the Japanese world, when you marry a woman, you're married for 999 years. So forever, you're married to that woman forever. She thought for sure he would come back to her because they had this marriage contract, which was signed and sealed by Japanese authorities. So the drama that unfolds then is multifaceted as to why an American in particular would even be there. But they would have to come to the library to find out because there's so much to say about it. But in actual fact, that very man had to be an American. He couldn't even be a Frenchman. So there are lots of levels to why these stories are written the way they are and why they're designed in that way. There are literary foundational principles for it. The other thing is why Puccini would have written in Italian is not because it's his natural language or it's his national language, but the Italian operas are in general more popular because the language itself is given to musicality. If you say "Buongiorno, Signore," you're already singing.
Let us take a call. We have Herb in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bela Miller. We're talking about opera and opera appreciation.
Good morning. I want to thank Jefferson Public Radio for carrying the Metropolitan Opera's broadcast on Saturday morning.
That's on our Classics and News Service. Yes, glad to do it.
And the Lyric Opera, I think it is, of Chicago, mm-hmm. on when the Metropolitan isn't in season. I've been listening to these just about all my life. And when I'm not listening to Jefferson Public Radio and I'm in the vicinity of my computer, I'm listening to iTunes. iTunes Radio Classical has currently 298 separate channels of classical music, which you can choose from, including some which are devoted to opera. And one case in particular, King FM out of Seattle, which has a full-time 24-hour-a-day opera channel. And another example is something called Calm Radio, which has a lot of separate channels devoted to particular composers, and one of them is full-time wall-to-wall Wagner.
Wow.
If you want a Wagner fix, you can listen to that any time of the day or night. So my particular interests are some of the more modern composers, which you seldom hear. I love to hear the Britten operas, for example, and ones by Janacek and Prokofiev, which are all of which are rare to hear.
All right.
So, thank you for this program, and I'm looking forward to your lecture series. I hope I can make it.
All right, thanks for the compliments, Herb,
and thanks for listening to opera and wow, an all Wagner channel. That could
I
have to listen to in smaller doses. Maybe not every day.
Well, you take over Poland by 12 o'clock, so that'll work.
That would be what Wagner would be up about. Just in general, when I think about talking to people about opera, it seems like the comparisons are very strong. People don't tend to say things like, "Yeah, I could take it or leave it." You know, it's more like, "No, I can't stand opera. It drives me crazy. It's like broccoli. I don't want it around me." Or, "Oh, it's wonderful. I love it." I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of middle ground. But and yet, anybody can go Figaro, Figaro, Figaro. We'll play Nessun Dorma in a minute. And I think most people know that piece as well.
Right.
So it's in the culture, whether people like it or not.
Oh, absolutely. It's on radio stations, on commercials, everywhere you can imagine. It's there, but they don't necessarily know that it's a famous opera aria. In actual fact, opera is easy for me to relate to simply because people don't realize that they're singing all day long. You see, in opera, one of the apprehensions they have about it is they can't relate to the fact that somebody is singing about going to pick up their laundry. Right? Or someone is going to just put the window down and they're singing about it. But in actual fact, we sing all day long. Because if your husband says to you, "Did you go to the store?" And you say, "Oh, yes, honey, I meant to do that, but I'm so sorry." Or you can say, "I did it already." But you see, this is the way that this is one of the reasons that the way that we communicate and we sing to each other, we can either do it sweetly or harshly, or it can be maybe middle ground. What happens with the composer that becomes such an important component of all this picture is he identifies the moods and the feelings that we have with either mundane movements through the day, mundane behaviors that we go through every day, or something that is heightened. Now, many years ago, when opera was first a form of entertainment around that 1500s period and as it grew, those people that had the box seats were the very wealthy people. Down in the center area was standing room only. There were no chairs or any. So people would come in for a few pennies to come and hear it. But what would happen for many hundreds of years, as in the opera seats, those people that were there had their servants serving them dinner. They were playing chess. There was a lot of commotion going on because people were visiting and laughing, and they would only stop for the aria.
Really? So the rest of it was background music?
It was background music. It was just somebody doing something in the background that, like, you would listen to classical music while you're washing dishes. So that's the way it was. It wasn't really meant to listen to, but you sort of looked at it here and there as you were visiting, talking, eating, or doing other things with gossiping, whatever. But when the aria began and they invented this concept known as the leitmotif, in which they were cluing you into the fact that this character is now going to sing an aria, that was the piece that everyone stopped for, and you could hear a pin drop.
On that note, here's an aria that just about everybody stops for. This is Franco Corelli singing Nessun Dorma from Puccini's Turandot. Franco Corelli singing Nessun Dorma from Puccini's Turandot. This is something that was actually used in the opening ceremonies of the 2006 Torino Olympics with Luciano Pavarotti, one of his last great performances. Yeah. So this is a song that the whole world has heard.
Yeah, of course.
May not know what it's from, may not know who wrote it or anything, but it's one of those ways in which opera pervades the larger culture, even if people don't know much about the source of the music or anything else.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because it has the power to connect with you as to how you feel. Literature teaches us how to think, but music teaches us how to feel. So when you know that someone is singing this song, you may not know necessarily that he is a prince that is afraid that he's going to be beheaded. You don't necessarily know that is the context of what he's singing about. Everyone is sleeping, but perhaps tomorrow I will be beheaded because Turandot doesn't want to marry. But what you learn from it is it's so grand. It's so on point as to how you would feel when you're hoping for something, when you're reaching for something. So every nuance of the note connects with you in a way that you can't identify, but they give you a name for it.
I have to ask if in the process of studying the history of opera, if you've figured out anything about the performance of opera along the way too, because it seems to me that this is not a kind of talent that just happens in, you know, half the population or something, the ability to sing like this.
Right.
And if there are any indications, obviously we don't have recordings from centuries ago, but if there's some indication of the quality of singing improving drastically over the years and when people actually began to train as opera singers.
Yes. Well, that's a very important point, because what happens when the instrumentation becomes more sophisticated, like when you move from the harpsichord, which is a plucking instrument, to a piano,
which gives you soft and strong.
And it gives you so many variations. It gives you all those different keys that you can train someone to hit a very specific key, as opposed to something that seems more harsh, because you can't get that pure sound from a harpsichord. Again, with the violin becoming so evolved as an instrument where you can express so much emotion with it, this is one of the reasons that piano and violin virtuosos are revered to the extent that they were, because every single nuance you can bring out of that instrument. So it can grow on the fact that a person has even more expression in their heart, and it can connect with the person that is listening in a way that is even deeper. It gives the character more layers. It gives the words more layers.
All the things a violin can do, plus the words.
Plus the words. So it becomes this joining of skills that is out of this world. Now, just like any time that Hamlet is played, it's played a little differently by the character himself. And every single night that he plays it, his character is nuanced slightly as well, according to what kind of a day he's had and according to how he's growing as a presenter. What happens in the opera world is that those same people that sing pieces time and time and time again, they're going to sound slightly different every time you hear them. And after all, this is, as you said, a handful of people in the international world that can make these kind of sounds, that can do, that have the capacity to act, that have the capacity to have this enormous memory. It's all about the voice and the structure of the human body as to which voices and sounds they can make.
Bela Miller's lectures will be at the Eagle Point Library at 4 on June 26th, the Jacksonville Library at 1 on June 28th, the Ashland Library at 2 on June 29th, Medford Library at 1 on July 1st. Contact the Jackson County Libraries if you need further information. Bela Miller, thanks so much. We're going to close with Libiamo from Verdi's La Traviata and invite our guests to stay tuned for the takeaway and to join us again on the Jefferson Exchange tomorrow. Bela, again, thanks.
Thank you.